Thank you for downloading from the BBC. For details of our complete range of podcasts and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Outlook from the BBC World Service. I'm Matthew Bannister. On today's programme, the Chinese-American author Amy Tan tells me about her extraordinary family secrets, including the day she found out her grandmother was a courtesan.
I was doing research on Shanghai and I bought a book that was about courtesan culture. And I saw a photo at one point and I was shocked because five of those women were wearing an outfit identical to what my grandmother is wearing in my favourite photo of her.
We'll have more from Amy Tan later. But first, before that, the best-selling author Amy Tan was born in the United States to Chinese parents, and she's never had to look much further than her own family history for fascinating plots. For example, the mothers and daughters featured in her best-known work, The Joy Luck Club, were based on her own experiences. And her latest novel, The Valley of Amazement, was inspired by a secret she uncovered about her Chinese grandmother. It tells the story of a courtesan in Shanghai in the early part of the 20th century. Here's Amy herself reading an extract.
As a courtesan, you must work toward the four necessities: jewelry, furniture, a seasonal contract with a stipend, and a comfortable retirement. Forget about love. To gain the four necessities, you must be popular, desired by many suitors who give you costly gifts. You offer no bargains, and you never accept anything less than what you are worth.
Amy Tan reading from her latest novel. She's been telling me how she was inspired to write it.
I was doing research on Shanghai and I bought a book that was about courtesan culture. And I saw a photo at one point and it was called The 10 Beauties of Shanghai, 1911. And I was shocked because five of those women were wearing an outfit identical to what my grandmother is wearing in my favorite photo of her.
What's the outfit like?
Well, the outfit has a hairband, for one thing, very specific. And it had pearls and embroidery, and it made a V at the very top of the forehead and slightly pulled the face up so that the eyes tilted in this nice phoenix shape, as they call it. The jacket was very tight. Collar went up to just below the earlobe. The sleeves were shorter and tighter, white lining, down to the wrists, matching bracelets, tight pants.
So did you start to think, was my grandmother a courtesan?
I thought at first about every single possibility that was not that, because the family myth now, I call it a myth, had been that she was quiet, old-fashioned, traditional, stay-at-home mom, and this clearly would show she was not old-fashioned. And that was the first thing that I knew she had not been. And the other is that, well, maybe she went to one of those studios where you could just have a picture taken in a costume just for fun. And then I read that one of the telling details is that it was taken in a Western photo studio with pots of flowers. It had some Western furniture and also a painted backdrop. And I went and talked to about three academicians whose research was courtesan culture in Shanghai around that period. And they said the photo studio was the most telling of the details, and it was because no woman went there except courtesans.
And what was it to be a courtesan in those days? What period of time are we talking about? The late 19th century?
Late 19th century.
In Shanghai?
Usually the girls started at about age 14 or 15, and their careers were very short. They lasted until about the time that they were 21 or 22, unless they were very good. There was so much competition. And once that happened, they had better have had a situation in place, meaning the concubine to a man, hopefully a rich man. If she didn't have that in place, if she had been a foolish teenager and spent all her money and hadn't cultivated a relationship with a patron, she might then be kicked down to a lower house, a second-class house, and then down the line to streetwalker. But the first-class courtesans actually could choose who the man would be who had their intimate favors. They literally were courted.
We use this word courtesan. I mean, this is a sort of word which makes it sound somehow glamorous compared to the word prostitute,
yes,
for example.
Yes.
Was there a difference between those two categories?
Well, they were in the sex trade because sex was involved, as was money. But they lived in these lavish houses, and the houses were often furnished with Western furniture and curtains and pastimes like billiards. And so the feeling of it was more of a club. Whereas a prostitute, usually you think of them being more a streetwalker or a call girl today.
Mm. It's notoriously difficult to write about sex. Were you worried about taking on that challenge?
Yes. Part of it was my own mortification, I suppose, that people might think that was my sex life. Because they always, no matter what I write, they think that it's but my life. They'll ask me about my daughters, and I don't have any, all these things. So I know that they would think, be reading this and say, oh, so that's what she does.
So do you get self-conscious as you come to those passages?
When I was writing them, I was very self-conscious, but not so with the ones about the courtesans, because that's a different kind of sex. That was business sex. Mm. The scenes that I think were most difficult were ones that involved intimacy, you know, genuine intimacy.
Because, of course, in this country, we do have something called the Bad Sex Awards, which are awards which are given for the worst writing about sex.
I hope I'm not nominated.
I'm sure you won't be a nominee for that. But I think the reason they exist is because people find it, you know, the people, even really good writers, sometimes descend into cliche when it comes to these things.
Yes, and, you know, it may not be the best sex scene, but it's my first time.
That's wonderful. You mentioned that people think that your books are all about your life. It's perhaps not surprising in a way, because your life has been the inspiration for your books.
Yes.
And obviously for your most famous book, The Joy Luck Club, came out of your own personal experiences. Is it an amazing thing to you that your life continues to provide inspiration in this way through this photograph of your grandmother?
Well, a lot of it is my family history, so it's not exactly that it's about me, but actually it is about me, because I'm fascinated in self-identity, who we become as a result of inheritance and inheritance of trauma or influences or, you know, things sudden, like the publication of that book, I never expected to be a success. How do we change, and what don't we change?
And also, in your case, it's about secrets, isn't it? Because, I mean, you had this extraordinary thing that you discovered your mother had left behind a husband and three daughters in China that you didn't know about.
Exactly.
How did you find out about it?
I was told at some point in my life, and the way that I remember it is probably collapsed and probably inaccurate, but I remember that my mother was very unhappy with me, and that suddenly she told me this, and that my feeling was she was saying, I wish that they were here and not you, that they speak Chinese and they would have been obedient and happy to have me as their mother, and here you are, you're an ingrate.
How did she come to leave them behind?
She had a terrible husband, an abusive husband. She'd been trying to leave him for years, and in fact she did once, and she was thrown in jail. She fell in love with a man who was going to the United States to study, and she left, 1949.
Leaving her children?
Leaving her daughters. I'm the one who's tried to come up with the reasons why she might have done that, and believed that maybe she could come back, and didn't know that the U.S. and China would cut off relations for 30 years.
But she never gave you the reasons?
She made it sound like the main reason, she couldn't tolerate being with that man, and I came up with some other reason, because it's unfathomable that a mother would leave her children. And the sense of abandonment that they felt, I've talked to them about.
Well, you got in touch with them, so that must have been quite a moment
when
you got in touch with these siblings you'd never known about.
And of course, I'm thinking that this could have been me. I could have been the daughter abandoned here in China. This would have been my life, working in a rice field, bent over, picking leeches off my legs.
I wonder if they also looked at you as you looked at them and thought, wow, here's a successful woman with a college education, a best-selling novelist. That could have been us.
I'm sure that they did. In fact, one sister who said she wanted to be a movie actress, but I was told for so long that I never would be able to be so now because my mind is rusted. And it stunned me to think, yes, you know, that question of who you become as a result of being told who you are all those years. You know, you have to be very strong to say no, despite what you're saying. I still have this mind.
I wonder if, to a certain extent, your writing is a kind of therapy for you, because I understand you took up writing when your therapist started falling asleep.
That was the only time I went to a psychiatrist, too. You know, I'm a bargain hunter, and there's, you know, it seemed ridiculous that I would pay a lot of money for the man to listen, for one thing, and then to have him take a snooze and ruin my self-esteem.
But you describe dealing with a lot of the issues that some people deal with in therapy through writing, dealing with the question of identity and self.
Yes,
and
yes.
Are you still working on that? I mean, are you still working out the mother-daughter relationships? They're there in this new book, aren't they?
They are. The one that has to do with the abandonment. So I realized, okay, here's something I realized about the abandonment, that my mother, in effect, was abandoned by her own mother. Her mother killed herself when she was 9, and she watched her mother die. And she said, my mother said, throughout the time that I knew her, for every unhappy thing in her life, she said, this would not have happened if my mother were alive. If I had had a mother when I was growing up, I wouldn't have married that bad man. I wouldn't have lost my child. I wouldn't have, you know, gone to America and had this child that then died. That the deaths of my older brother and my father were, it was as though that was also related to her mother's
Because
death.
They both died of brain tumors within a very short period of each other, didn't
and
they?
And it doesn't make any sense why, you know, the loss of her mother would have anything to do with the deaths of my brother and my father.
So she blamed all the bad things in her life on the loss of her mother at an early age.
Yes, but not with anger. She loved her mother, but she said that when her mother died, she wanted to join her, to fly away with her, and that metaphorically they had to put chains on her legs so that she wouldn't do that. What I think that meant, the chains, was her tendencies later to become suicidal. She attempted to kill herself a number of times, threatened it all the time.
Such an extraordinary story that it's almost not surprising to find that you've turned into a novelist, because there is so much rich material, so much extraordinary.
And it keeps coming.
Exactly. And was any of that behind your own decision not to have children? Because you've never had children yourself.
Well, there were a number of factors. One is that I wanted to do a number of things, and I had worked with children, and I knew you had to be very, very committed.
You did a lot of work with disabled children, didn't
yes,
you?
Yes, yes, and I knew that I would be one of these people who would not be comfortable letting the child out of my sight for even a minute. Then I would smother the child, and the child would grow to be a teenager and hate me, and then rebel as I did, and then probably do some kind of crime and go to jail. And
you could have looked on the bright side. Surely, Amy, you could have looked on the bright side. Might have turned out quite well.
we look at children who are now in their 30s, and my husband and I look at them and say, oh, we might have had it. No. We would have had, and then we point to somebody who's really terrible and unemployed and has some sort of drinking problem and say, that's the child we would have had, and so we're very glad.
Well, you're obviously very happy in your life with your husband. You've got a beautiful house in Sausalito in California, which I've been reading about.
Yeah.
And you've got there an extraordinary piano, I think. And the piano has been very important in your life, hasn't it?
How did you know that?
I've been reading about your life.
Right.
So you have a piano which, as I understand it, can reproduce famous performances.
Yes. We've had Elton John play in our living room.
So you press a button on the piano and it recreates one of Elton John's actual performances.
No, that's too easy. I have that as well. But it was playing simultaneously. You could hear him singing, but the keys were moving, the pedals were moving exactly as he was performing in Los Angeles. And I could see there was a computer monitor, and I could see exactly what he was doing.
That's amazing.
It was amazing.
What about your own playing? Do you play a lot now?
I do, but secretly.
You don't play in public.
I was traumatized when I was 6. That was the end of my piano career.
What happened?
I had my first recital, and it's, you know, in my memory, it was 500 people. I started playing very confidently, a little Bach piece, and then the fingering was wrong, and I got stuck. And I tried over and over again. And then in my mind, the audience burst into huge, raucous laughter. and I fled the stage. And
do you think you've exaggerated that just a little bit?
Probably. You know, as a child, this is what I've discovered as well, that as a novelist, you can go with that exaggeration. What you do is you put down exactly what it felt like and the way that it sticks in your memory. And
so it doesn't matter what really happened, because if that's what you remember, that's the truth.
That's what affected you. Mm. And, you know, that's why I always say, this is how it felt, or, you know, may not have happened the way that I'm describing, but in my memory, that's what happened.
But you're in a band. We know this because we had Scott Turow on the program quite recently. He's in the band too.
Yes.
Stephen King's in the band.
Yes, yes. And James McBride, who just won our National Book Award.
Right, so this is a band of authors.
Yeah.
What's the name of the band?
The Rock Bottom Remainders.
Right. And what's your particular role in the band?
Oh, I'm lead rhythm dominatrix.
Right.
And I play also second tambourine on backups.
And I believe that you perform These Boots Were Made for Walking.
Yes, that's my signature song. Well, what I do is I relive exactly the same disastrous recital, only this time I do it and people laugh and it's on purpose. So I forget my lyrics, and I guaranteed that it would happen at the last performance last week in Miami. I told Dave, I've had 2 hours of sleep. I always forget my lyrics, and I know I'm going to forget it this time. And so be sure that you laugh very loudly and then shout the lyrics to me. And that's exactly what happened.
So it kind of looks like it's on purpose.
Yes, yes. We make it part of the act.
Right.
And, you know, and it works. And then I suppose it's like a therapy, because I just do it. Now they laugh and I feel good about it.
The author, Amy Tan.